Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. Thanks again for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. If you enjoy what we do, please like, comment, and share in your favorite podcast app. And we'll keep sharing great conversations like the one we have for today. I'm your host, Dan Turchin, advisor at Insight Finder, the system of intelligence for IT operations, and CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. We learn from AI thought leaders weekly on this show. And the added bonus is you get one AI fun fact each week. Today's fun fact, AI tools can now detect employee burnout. An NLP model was recently trained on 13,568 Reddit conversations that had been hand-labeled as being associated with burnout. The model was determined to detect burnout in users posting new messages to the same Reddit forum with 93% accuracy. I will post a link to the full research report in the show notes, and I encourage you to check it out. Now, shifting to this week's conversation, all AI is a data problem. And all data hygiene is ultimately an information architecture problem. How we create, store, and retrieve answers to questions is the field of knowledge management, and the ability of AI to make life easier for employees at large companies is largely dependent on how knowledge management is applied in the enterprise. Well, today's guest is an expert on AI and specifically how it's used to improve knowledge management. In fact, Seth Early wrote the book on the topic, and it's called The AI-Powered Enterprise, in which he explains the importance of ontologies when applying AI. Seth is the CEO of Early Information Science. He's been advising companies on technology strategy since 1994, and he's currently focused on AI and knowledge engineering. Without further ado, Seth, it is my pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Let's get started by having you maybe share a little bit more about your background and how you got into this space.
Sure. And thank you so much for having me, Dan. This is really a pleasure. And I loved the intro and your preparation and your explanation of the space. And, you know, it's very rare for people to kind of understand that at that level of depth. And so you really did a wonderful job of explaining the principles that kind of drive all this. And so my background is, I actually have an undergraduate in chemistry, so I'm a scientist at heart. I went from biology to chemistry, and then I graduate school, went to business school for master's in business administration, but I have an almost MBA. I was one course short, and I remember the instructor for that market research course said, nobody who's ever taken an incomplete has ever finished this course, and I fulfilled that as well. And then I went back a couple of years later, they changed their accreditation. I said, okay, they didn't want to start all over. I'm like, I have enough. So I went into working for a small systems integrator after graduate school in kind of the sales, business development, marketing. But I was always interested in the technology behind all of the tools that were part of the customer solutions. And at some point, I had gotten introduced to Lotus Notes way back when. And we used to say Lotus did poorly what nothing else could do at all. And it was kind of the precursor to knowledge management. It was that whole collaboration and groupware. And actually, I worked on IBM bought Lotus, and they worked on their first foray into machine learning, which was called Lotus Discovery Server at the time. I co-authored a book on that technology. And then that became something called OmniFind. And that DNA went into Watson, right? So all of the work that has been done over the last, you know, few decades has really come to fruition in a lot of these tools. You know, a lot of people think that AI and machine learning are brandy new, and we know that the principle's been around for a very long time, and search has always done that. But I spent my time working on knowledge architectures, on information architecture, on knowledge management, collaboration. And over the years, you know, we always helped organizations build the flexible foundational architecture to support whatever tools they were bringing to bear, whatever transformations were happening, right? Because a digital transformation is a data transformation. And so you need to have that foundation. So we've always focused on the underpinnings of these tools. And, you know, several years ago, I wrote an article called "There's No AI Without IA." There's no artificial intelligence without information architecture. That's become a bit of an industry catchphrase, although IBM has co-opted it. They don't give me credit, but Tom Davenport, who has written a couple of books, and he's actually written 20 books. He was a pioneer in knowledge management, wrote me one day and said, "Ginni Romedy stole your line." It was at Davos, Switzerland, the World Economic Forum. She was CEO of IBM at the time and said, "There's a funny, you know, saying in our industry," when they were asking her about what the obstacles to AI adoption was. "There's no AI without IA." And then she went on to explain it. So anyway, it's great to have that type of thinking leveraged and cited and so on. But, you know, I was always looking at these tools and saying, you know, how do they evolve? You know, how do they learn? How do you build new capabilities? And when people talk about training AI and they say, "Oh, we need more training data. We need to train the AI. We won't have enough training yet." What are they training with? You're training with data. You're training with content. You're training with knowledge. And that information needs to be structured in a way that is appropriate to the solution. And sometimes, you know, people say that the data is more important than the algorithm, right? And if you looked at what was happening with things like Watson, you know, when they pointed it to the wrong data, the performance declined, right? Because people would start saying, "Oh, you just point your AI to everything." And I actually had a consultant who was on one of our webinars making that statement. And I said, "Well, that's going to be interesting because I'm going to disagree with you." Right? And then I gave him my premise. And the whole idea is we're always trying to contextualize the problem. We're always trying to contextualize the information. And we need to do the same thing with AI. We need to be very careful about the content and the data that we're using in support of the algorithm. And when you think about things like cognitive computing, when people talk about cognitive AI, well, what is that? There's no cognition, right? The tools, the technology doesn't think, right? But it reduces the cognitive load on the human, just like lots of applications have. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to surface information more readily to support a task. And it comes back to that right information at the right time for the right person, which has always been the mantra of knowledge management and personalization and contextualization and all of these types of things. So my interest in this, you know, came from my background in doing lots of knowledge management initiatives and building the information architecture and knowing that there's no free lunch, you know, that you have to make investments in the content and the data in order for these tools to be appropriate. So that's a long-winded answer of how I got to where I am. And I formed a professional services company, Early Information Science, and I started off doing, you know, application development and different types of knowledge processes. We've evolved and worked in the areas of product data management, product information management, customer journeys, customer data, first-party data, content operations, and then knowledge engineering, which supports, you know, bots and all sorts of cognitive applications.
So I want to understand a little bit more about your process. Take us through maybe a recent client success story. What was the challenge? How do you engage with them? And to the extent you can, share with us some results.
Sure. So there's a couple of good examples that came out of the book that I used in the book. One of them was Applied Materials, and Applied Materials is a semiconductor fabrication company. They build the technologies and the tools. They build semiconductor fabrication plants, and those fabs are very, very expensive, and they're very costly when they go down, costing millions of dollars per day. They had a field service organization that was spending about 50% of their time, or 40% of their time, searching for information. They had 14 different systems they had to go to get, you know, as-built information and part availability and technical drawings and troubleshooting approaches and all sorts of safety information and configuration documents and all of this stuff. And they couldn't bring laptops into the fab at the time. So they had to go out, find connectivity, and then they'd over-order parts, right? They'd fill their vans with all the possible parts that they thought they could use. And so a lot was tied up in inventory. They had tried to solve this problem. This is a knowledge problem. This is an integration problem. This is a semantic search problem. It is a problem of how do I get to this information when I'm out in the field and I have 14 different systems to go to, and it's very complex information. And so they tried that project a few times over a period of years, and they failed each time. And we were talking to one of the finance folks and said, you know, they're saying, well, why do we need taxonomies, right? Why do we need this ontology, knowledge architecture? Why don't we just get Google? And I said to the finance person, I said, do you have a chart of accounts in your finance organization? He said, of course I do. Why don't you get rid of your chart of accounts and just get Google? And it's like, well, of course I can't do that. So a taxonomy is a chart of accounts for knowledge, right? And we have multiple taxonomies. And so when you have multiple taxonomies and then you have the relationships between those concepts, that's when you have an ontology. So a taxonomy is a whole part parent-child set of relationships, right? In context, you know, Massachusetts is part of the US, Boston is part of Massachusetts, right? And, you know, or here's power tools, and a drill is a type of power tool, and a cordless drill is a type of drill. And then we have attributes and so on. So we build out that those organizing principles. And Applied Materials had about 30 taxonomies, as I recall, maybe 25 or 30 taxonomies. And what this did is it allowed us to do integration at the glass, right? So that we would have a knowledge portal that would actually be able to contextualize what the field service person wanted, get them that information, and it integrated structured and unstructured content. It pulled in information from the ERP system. It pulled in the as-built plans. You could use a visual parts identifier. So a digital asset management system was part of that. And then component authoring to break the problems up into pieces so that you could retrieve a specific answer. You know, when you're looking for information, you know, you can do a search, and if you get 100 results, that's not what you want. And then if you find one of those results is a 300-page document, you definitely don't want that. So we need to really take that information, break it into components, and be able to serve it up in lots of contexts. And that is something that saved them reduced the time that they were spending. They were spending 16 hours per week searching, reduced it to 8 hours, 50%, 3,000 field service reps, tens of millions of dollars in savings. That was one. And that was maybe a year-long project. And it was probably $1 million, but it was vastly successful. And another one I can mention, it's also from the book, was Allstate Business Insurance Expert, Abby. This is several years ago, before there were really any virtual assistants out of the marketplace. And at the time, the head of this Allstate was launching a new line of business insurance. And this gentleman had been my customer at the Hartford. And he said, hey, I need a new taxonomy. And I said, well, you need more than that. You need your content refactored and componentized. You need to do the search integration. You need to tune that search. You need to be able to build out multiple taxonomies. And then they said, and I thought of it as a retrieval problem, just an information retrieval. And when you think about it, chatbots are a channel, right? They're a channel to content, data, and knowledge. And so if we don't have that knowledge, we can't, you know, access it with these tools. So, and by the way, we use machine learning and auto categorization at Applied Materials. At Allstate, we were basically classifying intents, and we also did text processing of transcripts from calls. But they wanted to put an avatar on in front of it, and I was like, "That's a dumb idea. Why would you want to do that? That kind of seems silly." And in retrospect, it was brilliant. Right? Because people would come in the morning and say, good morning, Abby, how are you? Even though they know we were talking to a tool. It was really a search application on steroids. And so you could have a dialogue. It would walk you through the procedures. Again, very, very successful project, reduced their call center volume by something like 15% at the time, which is such an astronomical number. It's almost not believable to a lot of people in the call center industry, but they had launched a new line of business insurance. So there's a learning curve and so on. But it was for the agents. It wasn't customer facing. It was agent facing. So it helped with the productivity of the agent. You can train the agent. I think what people make a lot of mistakes with virtual assistants these days because they try to release these to the public before they're really ready. And I think if you do an agent assist bot, where you do a helper bot or a knowledge retrieval bot, that is a stepping stone to training your AI in order to be able to have it handle more use cases and more scenarios. We're actually starting a project now with a financial services company that has to grow by a factor of 10 in the next year. And we're looking at the knowledge architecture as the foundation for all of that. So that's the common thread. You know, the common thread is building isness and aboutness and building that across multiple dimensions. What is this thing? This is a policy. Well, how do I tell policies apart if I have a pile of 1,000 of them? That's the aboutness. Well, it's policy type and it's coverage type and it's, you know, customer type and it's region and it's all these other dimensions. And then when you have an utterance, like I need help with a policy, sure, what kind of policy do you need help with? I need help with employee actions for an employment agency in Massachusetts. Well, that's a bunch of different entities that are slotted compared with the ontology. And then you retrieve that information that is tagged in your content management system. And the componentization is so valuable because it can be used for things like personalization and other experiences. One organization that we worked with, a high-tech provider, actually handles 4 million knowledge transactions per day. And they do this without armies of content managers. They actually do create once, publish everywhere. We built the taxonomies and the architecture and the governance processes and all those methodologies and the component architecture. And then they ran with it. And they are 10 years ahead of the marketplace. But that's also using componentized content. Every single one of these applications use componentized content. You can solve problems today, solve your knowledge problems today while building for the future, even if you're not doing AI or cognitive assistance. You still have to make this information accessible to humans. And the same things you use to train a human, you need to use to train an AI. So it solves those problems.
Seth, those are great examples from the book. I enjoyed reading the book, the Abby example, the applied materials example. So the book is now a couple of years old. I think you published it in 2020. What's the chapter you would add if you were publishing a new version today?
So knowledge graphs, I talk about knowledge graphs. So when you think about the ontology is that scaffolding, right? That scaffolding, that structure for the knowledge and the information and the content and the data. And then when we add the data to that scaffolding, we have an access mechanism using a knowledge graph and graph data. And what I would think, what I would do is I would expand on that. I would really get into the details because knowledge graphs seem a little bit like, you know, people are saying they're brand new, but they're not, right? We've been doing faceted search for a very long time. And that is one of the applications of knowledge graphs, right? You have graph search and then the ability to get to other information and context. But it can really be valuable for personalization. It can be really valuable for building identity graphs, right? Where you're describing the customer and all the different attributes of the customer. And organizations need to do that more and more. They need a first-party data strategy. So I would do more about knowledge graphs and knowledge graph applications. I would probably add more around Internet of Things because there's so much more happening in that space as well. But, you know, I think I covered a lot of bases. You know, the more important things in my mind are things like governance, you know, and people kind of trivialize that or say, governance, really? when can you meet for governance? Let's see. How is never? Never works for me. I have never opened. Will that work for you? Right? Because it's such a boring topic. But, you know, we built a governance program for a publisher that lasted over 10 years, right? I talked to them. I remember we built it. It was supposed to be an 18-month roadmap. We built it. And then I remember a few years later, like 5 years later, I ran into them. I said, oh, you know, you guys used to call that the Bible. And they go, we still call it the Bible, right? It was the governance, but it was all the structures. They had 100 business units. They had so many. I think there were 2,000 cells on a spreadsheet to figure this out. And then you had another spreadsheet that talked about who needed to be at the table and then what were the roles and responsibilities. And it had everything down to the agendas of, you know, the structure for agendas for working sessions of task groups and all these different types of structures. And then I ran into them 5 years after that. And I said, you know, 5 years ago, you used to call that the Bible. And they go, we still call it the Bible. And then another 2 years, I last checked about 2 years ago, and after 12 years, they were still using it. So the point here is that I would add more on metrics-driven governance, right? Because the metrics, you need to measure the impact of these things, right? Why are you doing any of this? You to have some change on some metric, some operational process, some customer experience, some type of efficiency and effectiveness. And the critical piece is measuring that, right? And then when you make changes or have interventions or you deploy new technologies, what's the impact of that? What's the ROI? And if you have to change something, well, did you break it or did you fix it, right? So getting those metrics, and we like to instrument them across the entire customer journey. And you can measure the health of your technology deployments. You can inventory your technology deployments. You can measure the health of the data, build those scorecards, identify where the most impactful intervention will be, and then focus on that. But all of these require we build domain models and require that we build the ontologies and tell the AI what is important to the organization. Tell it what our products and services are and our solutions. It doesn't know that unless we articulate that. And of course, people need that. So that's kind of, I think that's where I would expand. It would really be digging into more of the applications of those knowledge graphs because they are so powerful because they can do so much for the organization. And then the justification. You know, I hear about a lot of knowledge graph projects that don't have a clear ROI. And I'm like, you spent $500,000 and you don't have anything you impacted? I mean, I know you have to build infrastructure and it's hard to measure the impact on infrastructure, but you should still be able to solve problems that show the value. I call it the excuse case, right? The use case that's the excuse for doing the thing you're doing. And then you can do all sorts of other stuff.
Seth, you said that Abby at Allstate is essentially performing a search task.
A retrieval
task. Virtual agent. For live agents, uh-huh. What is the benefit of layering AI, maybe NLP, on top of a traditional kind of keyword-based knowledge search?
So when you think about keyword-based knowledge search, it is if you build a good search engine, a good foundational architecture, it should be helpful. But the problem is that people use ambiguous terms and expect precise results. Right. So part of using a conversational interface, and I say search is a conversation, right? You put in a search term, you get some results back, maybe you get some facets or filters, and then basically the engine is saying, hey, here's what I think you asked for. But you know what? There's more context and clues and nuance here. So why don't you check one of these filters and tell me more? Essentially, it's asking the question, well, you want policies? Okay, here are all our policies. But there's 1,000 of them. Can you tell me what kind of policy you want? And that's what you're doing, that kind of search application. Essentially, we're doing the same thing with a conversation, right? We're saying, I need help with a policy. The system is saying, what type of policy? Or I can help you with the following kinds of policies. So what we're doing is we're disambiguating that query and we're being able to do it in more conversational fashion, just as a human would do that. Sorry, I have to clear my throat there. So in any case, the value of doing it that way is also based on the use cases and the scenarios. So, you know, one of the things about content is, you know, people are bolting on a content operations for cognitive AI or for virtual assistants, for chats or for AI. They're adding it on. They're bolting it. They have all their content operations, which is very fragmented. I use a slide that shows this, you know, really fragmented landscape. And then you add cognitive operations on top of all of them. And the point is that, no, this should just be content operations. And why is content for a cognitive assistant more effective? Why is that? Because we think through the use case. We think through what that user needs. We very precisely define the content needed for that use case. Guess what? That's how content should be written. You know, I did work for a Medicare administrative contractor, a MAC, right, which is an insurance company that processes Medicare claims. They had 20 people in a department creating content, did a workshop, held up a piece of content. And I said, what is this? Who's it for? Why will they read it? Nobody could answer that question. They created the content because they were supposed to, because stuff came down from the administration and they had to document and they had to write it. But you have to think through the purpose of that content. And that's why developing it for these very focused use cases, these narrow use cases. And again, you can expand from that, but saying, what does this person want in this context, accomplishing this task, given their background, given their equipment, given their problems, given their history? It's like you're gathering all these other signals and using it to contextualize exactly what they want. And that is really how we need to. Right now, the way we're doing AI with content and knowledge is we're further fragmenting the ecosystem, right? We're not doing create once, publish everywhere. This vendor, this tech company publishes that content out to channel partners and distributors and field service and customer self-service and call center and actually embedded content within the products themselves and to all the, to email marketing, to everything that you can imagine. They create that once and they publish it to all those channels. Well, that is the way, that is the way that organizations need to think of their content. They need to think about those downstream consuming applications, and they need to think about who is it for, why do I build it, and then what is that really concise way of writing it. I have an example from when I was trying to activate a credit card, and the credit card, I took the sticker off, so I didn't have the phone number. I looked everywhere. I went, I had these conversations with these virtual assistants that would give me page after page of information about my credit card, information about this and this and this and this. And I'm like, where's the damn number? You know, and everything I put in, activate card, you know, dial a number to activate, you know, whatever it was. I used every phrase I could think of, and I would not get the information. That's a typical use case that should be easy to program to say, okay, I recognize that intent, activate your credit card. Here's how you do that, right? So that's the problem with, you know, with how we're looking at, you know, content and content processes and, you know, contextualization. And it really needs to be thought through from a different perspective. Now, by this time, I've totally forgotten your question, so I don't know if I've answered it or not.
You answered it quite effectively. So let's say you're talking to an audience that nodding in vigorous agreement with a lot of the comments and the theory behind the value of ontologies and knowledge engineering and even cognitive computing. But let's say they're immature in their process. Where do they start?
Yeah, this is such a good question. And I'll tell you, a lot of companies are going to be caught flat-footed on this. You know, as you know, in the book, I wrote a scenario and about the future of this gentleman, Alan Perkins, and he's going about his day interacting with virtual assistants and cognitive agents. He has some that work for him that know his preferences. There's others that work for other people and so on. That will be our future, right? These things are not very good today. One day they will be excellent, right? One day they will be seamless. They will just be part of how we do business. We know that time will come. Between now and then, what's the stumbling point? What is the obstacle? It's the data, it's the content, it's the knowledge, right? In the right format. So companies that don't do this or touch this or think about this are going to be caught flat-footed. We'll have blockbuster in Kodak moments, right? Not the Kodak moment that they used to talk about, but the Kodak moment as in you're out of business, right? And people will be scrambling. There was going to be a tsunami of need. So if you have not started this or you're early in that process, what needs to happen is you need to think through use cases and scenarios. You need to pick a problem to solve. And you need to think about, well, who's going to be impacted by this? There's all sorts of ways of doing prioritization. We actually do workshops on helping organizations set up these strategies. And one of the things you want to do is say, well, what are the pressing, burning problems and issues? If people say it's customer support or it's customer service or it's voice of the customer or it's customer experience, right? Everybody wants to do that. And you have to say, well, within that experience, throughout that journey, where are the friction points, right? Where do people have difficulty accessing information or getting to a problem? Why do people call the call center in the first place? Because something is broken, right? So you have to go upstream and find that broken piece. But no matter what your process is, no matter what your objective is, you have to start by understanding those processes. I like to use the customer journey because everything at some point supports some customer, right? And if you support the people that are supporting the customer, you can have an impact. So when you map that customer journey, you need to think about a couple of things. You need to think about, well, as they go through this life cycle, where do they get the answers, right? Where do they get the information and the content that they need? And again, if they can't find it, they're either going to go to another site or they're going to pick up the phone. So it's mapping out that process. It's defining the problem space and then looking at where you can have an intervention. So it's not a matter of taking an AI tool and just installing it and applying it to whatever we're using the process. It's really trying to identify, like the work that you do in employee service, right? Many times people just have questions they need to answer, right? And they need to find those answers. They should be able to self-serve. And if you have people answering a phone when someone should be able to answer that question by themselves, then you're wasting money. So it's deconstructing those processes. I like to say you can't automate a mess, and you can't automate what you don't understand. So it's identifying those supporting processes. If you start with the customer journey, you can actually measure the impact at multiple levels, but you can also measure the efficiency and effectiveness of the upstream processes that are supporting that customer. And then you look for interventions. Where can I make that more efficient? Where can I reduce the friction? Because at the end of the day, you're trying to speed up the entire information metabolism of the enterprise. You're trying to make it easier for everybody to get the information so that they can produce their output. One person's input is another person's output, right? And your output is somebody else's input. So when you can't find stuff, when you have to go through acts of heroics to, you know, get to the content or launch the product or rebuild the report or whatever, that is unnecessary friction. And I like to say acts of heroics do not scale, right? We cannot scale. We're going to burn people out, to your point. I love that example around burnout. What are the signals that we're getting from that? So no matter what you're trying to accomplish, you want to think through what that process is. You want to understand where the friction points are. Where are we not? And the information leverage points. Where, if we have this information, can it speed up downstream processes? Where is it getting the most bang for the buck? And this, again, like I say, there's a lot of different ways of slicing and dicing and prioritizing. But once you identify the process of interest, it's building out that experience, that journey throughout that process, and then understanding how is each step of that process facilitated? How is it supported? How is it built, right? Because our entire digital experience is data, right? And content, everything is. So, and there's an architecture behind it. You know, a physical supply chain is an information supply chain, right? And so when we think about it, everything we're doing, and even what companies build, I like to say, all you're dealing with is knowledge. Even you manufacture products. What is this? My magical device. I'm holding up my phone. It's sand, metal, and oil, all very cleverly arranged. Right? It's knowledge. And so we have less physical materials in our objects, and we have more knowledge. So all we don't walk around with Krugerrands and pay in silver, right? That's not, that's information. It's ones and zeros. Everything is knowledge, right? In even the physical goods. So to me, it's so important for organizations to get a sense of their core processes, understand where they have inefficiencies, understand where they have friction points, and understand it from the perspective of who's on the ground. I wrote an article recently about Verizon, and it was my experience of trying to upgrade my phone, right? It started off as a major rant, like just me complaining for pages. And then I had to keep tuning it and tuning it. And I finally came up with 6 fails and 6 fixes, right, for their experience. Now, what was really interesting is if you go to any of the Verizon research and you go to the website and you do searches on the digital transformation, all they say is motherhood and apple pie, you know, wonderfulness. It's like everything is great, rainbows and unicorns. But, and that's what gets communicated to the board and the executives. When you go on the ground, it's very different. So for executives, it has to be a way of getting to the unvarnished truth about the problems. And there's too much of the politics and the positioning and this, the, I like to say it's success theater, right? Where, oh yeah, everything's great. We're doing great. This transformation is spectacular. And then you talk to people on the ground, like, this is horrible, you know? So if you don't have the reality of what's on the ground, you can't fix that. And if you don't understand what it takes to facilitate these things and to enable them, because it takes huge investments in the data. Why does AI work in pilot or POC or sandbox and then not work in production? Because it's very different. You know, they say data scientists spend more time being data janitors, right? And when you're in a POC or pilot, you're lovingly caring and crafting that data and fixing it and having the right stuff and tuning the algorithm. Guess what? You get to production, you don't have that luxury. So organizations and executives need to bite the bullet and say, I'm going to spend the $10 million I need on this data initiative. Now, why do they not want to do that? Because they've been burned. And they've been burned badly. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I interviewed a head of AI at a large insurance company. He said, I don't know any companies out there of our size that have not wasted $5 to $10 million on failed AI initiatives. And because organizations have been burned so badly, you know, it's hard to have that credibility to say this is going to work, but you have to be able to show a track record and show a process and show a success and have it make sense to people. I love to hear people pushing back, right? I love to hear people poking holes. I'm always looking for what's wrong with this, right? If you put in a deliverable or you say this is the way it is, tell me it's wrong, right? Tell me what's wrong with it, because that is getting to the reality. Don't pretend it's good. Don't pass it on and say, oh yeah, this is awesome. Poke holes in it, right? Find what the problems are. That is the only way you're going to get to reality. And that is the only way you're going to be able to solve these problems with any type of any type of sustainability, right? Because, you know, there's lots of shiny new technologies and you deploy them and then they get crappy and messy and ugly. And people say, oh, we need a new tool. And then they do it again, right? So it's recognizing the boring parts. There's a great book called The Innovation Delusion. And it talks about how many executives are so enamored of innovation that they forget the maintenance and they don't budget for that because it's boring and it's not fun. And it's much more fun to deploy a shiny new technology and get excited about that. Data, you know, content, knowledge, architecture. Yeah, no, I don't want to do that. We'll offshore that. Right? We'll bolt it on at the end. We'll think of it later. And then that is the critical underpinning. And that's why these projects are not successful or don't realize their true value.
Hey, Seth, I got to get you off the hot seat, but I'm not letting you go without answering this one last question for me. We can't talk about knowledge and content and AI without thinking about the ethical implications potentially having data bias seep into the AI models that we train with the data. In your field, how do you think about that intersection of knowledge, content, and AI and ethics?
That is such a good question. It is so difficult. And I think one of the problems that we have in the space is that there is a lot of cultural bias, right? Because we're thinking about audiences that look a lot like us, and we're not necessarily planning for those. One of the things that we have to do with this financial services company is we really do need to look at different personas and different types of people and different types of individuals and accommodate those cultural differences and those stylistic differences and those differences in education, right? And language and everything. And I think that, you know, especially when you get into things that are making decisions about screening of resumes or about, you know, job performance, or, you know, some of the more serious ones about, you know, criminal justice and sentencing and recidivism. I mean, all of those things have so many minefields about bias and ethics. And I think we have to be able to make sure that it's passing the sniff test. We have to be able to have humans in the loop who are monitoring this and be really critical. When you meet a vendor and the vendor has a pre-trained model, tell me about the training data. Tell me how you trained this. Tell me about how you're tuning the algorithm. Tell me how you're dealing with bias. And so it is really incumbent upon the organizations that are deploying these technologies to ask those difficult questions of the vendors. And it really comes down to, what are the use cases? What's the training data? Where did this training data come from? And is are we doing all we can to be conscious and aware of the bias? Because there will be bias, right? There will be bias. I mean, if there's data that's coming from a source and, you know, that source has a perspective. And again, we have to be very careful about the application and how much trust we're putting in the AI. And we always have to express human judgment. We always have to look at that, you know, and say, is this a reasonable thing? And not, you know, give away our control, not give away our judgment and just hand it over to the AI. That is a critical area. And when you start building bots, and, you know, one of the things I think that is going to be in the future of cognitive AI is making very sophisticated resources available to people who don't necessarily have the means, right? Like if everybody could afford a $300 career coach, you know, you'd have less unemployment, right? You'd have people that would live more fulfilled lives. Well, guess what? Many people can't access that, but we can make that accessible through cognitive AI. That is my objective down the road is to support those things, because the AI is going to cause problems. It's going to cause displacement in the marketplace and in employment. And it always has, right? I do a presentation where I talk about obsolete jobs, and I did a search on Google and Career Builder came up with, find the obsolete jobs for you, right? And it literally interpreted that as a search for obsolete jobs. But again, Proctor, you know, the guy that read to the audience, read to factory workers, was replaced. There was somebody who wouldn't wake people up in the morning. My point is that displacement is going to be caused by these tools. Those tools are also going to be the solution to that displacement, to reskill and retrain people and give them meaning, give them purpose, help them find their own voice and help them find their value in the marketplace and in their career and in their lives, right? Because people get value from work. And when you take away work, what are they going to do? You know, they need to find something. So they need to find something they're passionate about. They need to find new skills. They need to find new opportunities. And again, we have those tools that can help to facilitate that. And that is incumbent upon this industry to be able to support the people that have been traditionally underserved. And that is critical. Otherwise, we're going to continue to see the disparity increasing. And that is something that society really can't afford.
Seth, we've had versions of that conversation about the ethics of AI probably 40 or 50 times on this show. And that is one of the most articulate summaries of the implications of ethics and data and AI models. So thank you. That was very well said.
Thank you for the kind words.
Well, Seth, time flew by, but we're at a point we got to wrap. We just scratched the surface about so many of these topics. Maybe you're going to have to come back and have a second version of this conversation.
I would love to. I really enjoyed it. And thank you for your questions. And thank you for having me. This has really been a pleasure.
You bet. And where can the audience learn more about you and your work?
Oh, you can connect with me on LinkedIn. You just look for Seth Early, and it's E-A-R-L-E-Y. Don't forget the E before the Y. You can also write to me at seth@early.com. So just my first name at lastname.com. Or you can go to www.early.com. Again, don't forget the E before the Y. I should have bought Early with the Y at the same time I bought E-A-R-L-E-Y. I don't know why I didn't think of that. I was trying to hide from people. But www.early.com, seth@early.com, or Seth Early on LinkedIn. And I love to talk to people about this stuff, and happy to take conversations and talk shop or get to know what your problems are and perhaps help. So please feel free to reach out.
Well, there you have it. Seth Early, author of The AI-Powered Enterprise. That's a wrap for this week on AI and the Future of Work. But we are back next week with another fascinating guest.